Spinners of Yarns, Rule Galloway. I'm here with Big Bob Morris, Ace Face of East London. How you doing, Bob?
All right, mate, not too bad.
So, kind of like, you're born in the East End, funny enough.
What? Yeah, no, not really. It's East London.
So East London, okay.
And once you go beyond, as I've been told by many, many mates, I'm actually an Essex boy.
Yeah.
Because past the River Roding,
yeah,
which is like Mile End.
Yeah.
It was Essex up until 1965, I think. So it was County West End, County Borough Council or something like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Forest Gate was sort of where people moved from the East End, but all the families from the East End. And most of my family come, like, three brothers, three sisters, all brought up around Stratford.
Yeah.
And then I was Forest Gate, just up the road, really.
But you kind of like, because music and fashion have been the two things for your adult life. When did you first become aware of music?
Well, that's the thing. It's like, it's very early. Like, I'm surprised how early it is, but I really remember, like, this question I've been asking for 20 years to people is, what was the first record you bought with your own money? And I think I went into famous record shop Paul's at Whitechapel, down Mile End Waste, it's called, but it's Whitechapel. And I went down there and I think I was going to buy Shawaddy Waddy, which were probably going to be number one, or yeah, were number one, and they didn't have it. So, but you could buy, I think singles were 25 or 30 pence, and Decimalisation had just come in. And I bought Snooty versus the Red Baron and Mouldy Old Doe by Lieutenant Pigeon, and like, I've still got them two records. I've kept them for all the records I've lost. I've kept them, surprisingly, never played them out, I don't think. But it's like 1973,
yeah,
or 1972, sorry, 1972, I was eight,
yeah,
like, on my birthday's in December,
yeah,
and I was eight and I was buying my own records, you know,
yeah,
what I mean? It's
mad
to think, yeah, how, like, you know, my mum had let me go in and buy, like, to the shop, and she was at a market stall, whatever. And it was there, you know, and then, you know, Sweet, Slade, Mud, you know, all through all those bands and all that.
Yeah.
And then hearing brothers, my mate's brother playing us the Rolling Stones and Beatles and all that. But really, really young.
Yeah.
We all was.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
what I mean? We,
yeah,
all,
yeah,
sort of, I think our generation with that sort of first generation to experience music that early.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then, yeah, like, because when you go back, you look at people who are into rock and roll and skiffle, they was like 14, 15.
Yeah.
You know, in the sort of 50s and early 60s, and the same with the mods, same sort of age. And then we were all like 8, 9, 10. Everyone had was talking about music.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
what I mean? I was a bit, you know, I was a bit sort of anal about it, because I'm just obsessed over the records and Chin and Chapman. I met Mike Chapman, like, one of McGee's dudes last year, or a year before last.
Yeah.
And I went, it's your fault. And he went, what do you mean? I said, oh, like, Chin Chap. I said, Sweet. I said, that was you that introduced me, and I remember reading your name everywhere,
yeah,
wondering who you were,
yeah, yeah,
and why weren't you in the band? But they couldn't write for shit, could they? So, yeah, it's like, music's always been a massive part of my life, and I think, not sure whether it just came in from the East End, because the more you talk about people, like we were talking about earlier, you see how much, you see how much our lives, our working class lives, sort of mirror each other.
Yeah.
No matter where you are in the country, you've got, like, similarities with experience. But I think, yeah, and fashion, I think it just goes along with that. And, you know, I just, you know, it was like, remember, you know, not wanting to go out because I didn't have a jacket to wear, you know, for a party. When I was probably pre-teen, probably 11 or 12, do you know what I mean? It's like,
yeah,
you know, that, you know, it was that, oh, I can't go because I wore this jacket last time, and, you know, but luckily my nan was in the rag trade, so, like, you know, we you know, the next week when there was another party, she went and got me a jacket, you know what I mean? And it was like, you know, big wide lapel. I remember it was like Prince of Wales check, big, well, it was a suit, I think. And it was, we were all grown up, you know, wearing big wide lapel suits, and then, you know, the sort of soul boy thing with the pegs and granddad shirts and all that, and then punk rock cup.
Were you a punk, or you liked the music, didn't you?
No, I liked music, but it's like I've just been doing that sort of 20 albums thing on Facebook that influenced you, and you know, and I put up Rumours,
Power in the Darkness,
out of the Blue, ELO. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, they were massive albums to me. Really, you know, I could still sing all the old double album, ELO, all backwards, forwards, and, you know, certainly forwards and backwards, but Rumours as well.
Yeah.
And and then it was that sort of time, 77, 78, and Oh, and Live and Dangerous, Thin Lizzy.
Yeah.
Massive album. Like, you know, never been to a live gig.
Yeah.
But that album, I think, just sounds like a live gig.
Yeah.
And like, we, you know, another conversation, because of, you know, we conversation in the pub last week, and it's just like, it's got to be the best live album ever, do you know what I mean? You know, there's, you know, James Brown at the Apollo, but that really weren't our generation, obviously.
No.
Or Lou Rawls at the Cabana or whatever. Nothing compares to that Live and Dangerous. And when you listen to it in modern day, there's a lot of punk involved in it, you know what I mean? It's fucking 100 mile an hour.
Yeah.
Really is, you know what I mean? So that, and then, you know, and obviously, then punk came along and it was just singles. You know, really, you know, really was heavily, you know, for every, you know, probably buy 10 singles for every album.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's, you look at it and you think, they're probably right, you know what I mean? I remember getting a, I suppose it was December 78, getting the Roxy, Live at the Roxy album. It was fucking rotten. It was terrible. It's punk rock, I don't want to be involved.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was a terrible album, like, you know what I mean?
But it was a cash-in album, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, you don't know that. Yeah, yeah. My brother bought it for me, my middle brother bought it for me, like, because he knew I liked punk, and it was just like, it was terrible, you know what I mean? And it's like, in the city, couldn't get that, didn't get that at all. Like, and then, I was having a disagreement with someone. Today, actually, with my mate, about another music, I put up Love Bites as one of them albums.
Yeah.
And I said, but different music, another music in a different kitchen was a grown-up record. And we didn't, I didn't understand, 13 or 14, I didn't get it. I thought it was shit as well. And I took it back and I swapped it for this year's model, I think.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then the Love Bites I kept, I've still got that. You know what I mean? It's a brilliant pop album, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
But it's how your music, how your ear changes, how you listen to music just makes all the difference. And I think that's the thing. And the same with, like, Jam's first album. It's just an R&B album, you know. That's a pub rock covers band, but young, you know, 16, 17, and like listening to that, and they're just going, I love that single though. Like, you know what I mean? All around the world, brilliant single. This is a brilliant single. Yeah. In the cities, they're all brilliant singles.
Yeah.
Same with the Buzzcocks. Yeah. Every single was amazing. You know what I mean? And I was saying about John Peel earlier, and it was like, remember Under the Covers, and he played Spiral Sketch both sides, you know, the whole EP, and I thought that was amazing, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And had to go to Small Wonder in
Walthamstow
to get it, Hippie Pete, and he was lovely, and that was the first record I remember buying from him.
Yeah.
And he was a lovely bloke, you know, and his mind of information, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I'm sort of, by sort of 78, I turned, started wearing a parka and all that, turn mod, but whatever version mod I was, you know what I mean? And anything came in, he'd know, oh, you're like this, you know, you're like that, you're like, you know, Long Tall Shorty, and, you know, all that, certainly through that period, he made man for the sort of mod records, because they weren't getting played on the radio.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's, it was just like, I mean, it was just that, and then starting to go to the gigs, and in the same, I think it was the same month or a month or two apart, so he's status quo at Wembley and Tom Robinson Band at Gantsu Odeon, and the week after during the Blockheads, and I think the week after the Banshees, but I can't swear to that one. But you know, we like, the reason I had status quo tickets, because we're all status quo fans in 78, like 77, and you buy a ticket 6 months in advance. By the time we had four tickets, I ended up going to Wembley Arena on my own in a parka with three tickets in my pocket, and then we bought these tickets. I didn't know what to do.
Like, was there a big West Ham mod?
There wouldn't be a mod scene without West Ham. There would definitely. I mean, there were talking people, over years, like Chad in Southend, Gary Wood. They were influenced by Quadrophenia, probably 4 or 5 years older than us, and they were, got into it from that. But I think the scene, that there was something missing. I mean, me and my mates certainly didn't want to be skinheads because they were all NF. That was just, we lived in Forest Gate, all after our mates were West Indian and Asian, and Irish as well, that was the mixture. It was just like that was that was the sort of choice, and then the thing that come through from like Grant and Harrison and all that lot in West End, like top boys, they were dressing in this, like the Jam sort of thing, and they were dressing in that certain way. That's what. But I remember asking one of my mates, who's a bit older, I said, what are they wearing? He said, oh, they're mods. I went, oh, I like that. He said, I'll take you up Mints and Dave's shop in Romford and get the gear. So I got me, I got me money. Oh, I know. Me and Glenn Pearman, me and my mate was bunking off school then, but during the 6 weeks holidays, he got a job washing up for an agency in the city. And so we had to make out we was 18, or make out we was 16, I think we was 14, and go and do washing up, and we was getting £30 a week. Fucking brilliant, Like early start, and finished early, so you could still go out to play or go fishing, whatever. And we were just like, so we had money. And I went up there and I bought a parka, stay press, two pairs of Levi's stay press and a parka. I think it was a tenner, a whole lot. Like £2.50 for the trousers, stay press, a fiver for the parkas. About a month later, I took two of my mates up there and the parkas were a tenner. But this is 78, this is before Quadrophenia and anything, and it was just like, that's how quickly it took off. It was a matter of weeks from like seeing like who would become the Glory Boys, back of the South Bank, to like seeing how they were dressing, seeing it weren't skinhead, and weren't NF and weren't all that, and didn't come with all that. No one was punk. I still say this to this day. They were not mates West Ham, like they had spiky hair, but that was about it. That was they weren't like no geezers walking around with safety pins at Upton Park. So I think that was the thing, that mod sat in that way. It just came along at the right time, that people were looking for something to identify with. Do you know what I mean? And you know, by the season, like 78-79 season, you'd look in the South Bank, it was all parkers, MA1s. I mean, like the whole mob. And going to away games, going Tottenham away or Chelsea away. It was just mobs of green jackets, parkers and MA1s. That was it. And it was Crops and college boys, It was like everyone looked really alike, So that was the first big culture I see over there. Obviously there was the skinhead thing before that, but that's the thing with, and then music come along with it. So that was, we were going to see punk bands, you might go and see two bands a week, might go and see a punk band and might go and see a mod band. You had the choice.
You could go out every night of the week, couldn't you?
Any school night, we ended up, because the Bridge House got a bit, because it was busy, it got a bit, started turning us away because we were underage. Right, we were obviously underage.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? We were spotty 14-year-olds. And like...
But then, you would have been big at that point.
Yeah, I was
not,
tall.
Not big.
No, but yeah, no, I was. But that's why I was big Bob. So yeah. I was big.
Yeah.
But it was still like, no, you can't come. But it was because I spoke to the geezer that had done the door, Glenn, and he went, no, we just couldn't let any more in. It was mental.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, like, you'd get, you turn, and it was Canning Town and Forest Gate was quite a slip because it was like a bus, and it's a bit dangerous territory, Canning Town, because it was, you know, Stratford and Canning Town were always at war with each other, and it was where you from, and Bonehead's.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? All the way there. So you go through Plaistow, up for Barking Road and in the Canning Town, it's Bonehead territory and coming back. But we discovered the marquee. So I've been to the marquee a few times, and then once I went with two mates who were both a year older than me. Like you say, Barney was little and Boy Racer was sort of tall but skinny, looked younger than me. And the bouncer let us in, let me in, didn't let them two in. And he pulled me at one side and he said, here mate, he said, I know you're all underage, he said, but I didn't let your mates in because they're so pissed. I went, oh, all right, cheers mate. And he went, but what you want to do, he goes, go over there, give them 50p and get membership. And he goes, and you've got like, getting all the time. So. And they'd done it, you could like send off for membership. I've got two forms,
yeah.
And I've done mine there and then, and I've got two, lied about my age, we'd be used to that.
Yeah.
And got two forms, and Barney and Boy Race had done it, and just went to the marquee. Got, even when there weren't anything we knew on, we'd just go up there,
yeah.
Just because it was 20 pence to get in, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that ended up with a few of us went up there for... when they were doing like John's Boy, so this would have been 79, they'd done a like secret gig under the name John's Boys, and my mate then went at school, I think it was someone else, Muttley went, who'd left school, but he was a year above us, and he went, oh, the jam are doing a secret gig at the marquee under this name, and he said this name, and it made sense for some reason.
Yeah.
So we've gone up there, bumped off school, lunchtime, gone up there, met Muttley, met a few others, got on the train, gone up there, got to the marquee, this big sign on the door saying where it was, and we're going, oh, couldn't see anyone, like couldn't see... No queues of people. I mean, it's the fucking jam.
Yeah,
there should have been a queue by lunchtime, like say 1 o'clock, whatever time it was. There would have been a queue around their block, like there was a couple of months before. Anyway, like da, da, da. And then we've seen a few. Like if you walk round up the alleyway, up the side where the car park was, there was the backstage bit, like loading. Seen a couple of great geezers unloading gear. Oh mate, what's the band playing? And the Irish fella went like. Oh, there's the rock band. I went, oh, fucking hell. Like, Muttley, slagging Muttley off. And then we've got our, like, 10 bobs, whatever we had for beer, and went down the ship. So we sat in the ship. Yeah. And Jerry Floyd, the DJ, was in there.
Yeah.
And he was a funny bloke. He was always nice. But he's, oh, you lads. He said, we've got a band tonight. He played sold no tickets, and we're going, oh, that what? He went, oh, and he bought us all a light and lager, and he went, look, if I give you a fiver, or a ten, I think it was a tenner between us, like a couple of quid each, if I give you a tenner, would you give some tickets out, go around the Carnaby Street, the West End, and give some tickets out to cool people?
Yeah, yeah.
We went, yeah, yeah, all right, yeah, we'll do that, so give us a big wedge of tickets. And we've gone up to Carnaby Street and like going up to sort of rocky types and punks and oh, you've got to come and see this band, they're brilliant, they're amazing.
You didn't know who it was?
I did know who it was because I'd seen the name, but one knew who that fucking was then.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, obviously, it's sad in this in hindsight, I know the story now because I've read about it. But so we've gone to the, here we go. We've gone to, we give all these tickets out, and he said, what I'll do is, he'd give us a tenner, like a couple of quid each, and then he goes, I'll give you a case of beer. And what you used to get these cans of, I think they were Heineken, like half cans, like in the Marquee Club, like these little half cans. And he gave us a case of them. So we're in there, there's like eight or nine little urchin mods. And there was 81 people in the Marquee. 81 people. Who were they watching?
The Jam.
No.
Who?
You two. It was their first night of their residency the Marquee.
Yeah.
And it was 1980, I think. Yeah. 79. I think it was 79. 79 or 8. No, it was 79. Must have been John's boys. They was playing their first night, and I read, my mate had happened to have the book on his shelf, like the thing. I said, I've got to look this gig up, you know, years later. And it was like the story of that first night. There was 81 people in there, and like at least at least nine of them were mods, and the rest of them were like, we'd brought them anyway, we'd give them free tickets. Like, no one bought a ticket. I think they'd probably sold like 10 tickets or something.
Yeah,
and then the next week it was busy, and then busier and busier, and then it was round the block.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was their first ever show in like, well, not first, I don't think it was their first, it weren't their first London show, because they played the Bridge House.
They played Bridge House, didn't they?
Yeah.
So when did you mingle with mods from south of the river? North London, West London?
Well, I don't think we had much. No, not really. There was a lot of, like, it was football-like.
Right, yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's like East London. If you was at a gig, like Marquee, wherever you was. I mean, it kicked off quite a few places. Westway went off mental. What was the club under the Westway? I think it was going
Acklam
to see...
Hall.
Yeah, Acklam Hall. We went to see Squire or something. And the West London mods were with the skinhead.
That was a famous one, that one, wasn't it?
But, well, there was a famous... Rejects had it off there, didn't they? Proper. So, like, Secret Fair, with the Glory Boys. That was a big one.
Yeah.
But, we went there and we had it with them. So that started a feud with sort of Acton and Shepherd's Bush mods. There was always a feud with South London, because as far as we were concerned, they were all fucking Millwall. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, so there would always be, you know, in that first couple of years, there'd always be a bit of friction. But then once it all calmed down, once, like, Quadrophenia had been and gone, and then everyone had turned, you know, everyone had turned casual, it was like, the mod clubs we were doing, by that time we were doing our own nights.
Yeah.
It was like, don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? We're all mods. That was it.
Yeah.
You know, that was our identity, and there weren't enough of us to go round.
Yeah.
To row with each other. You know what I mean? Yeah. You'd still get, oh, this one's chatted that one bird up, and we had to go to a pub in South London or Woolwich or somewhere.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But it was just normal stuff. But before then, it was, there was friction at most of the gigs. You know, especially like, you know, the sort of mosh. Our version of mosh pit was folks going like that.
So how did the whole casual thing come about then in West Ham, Upton Park?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I mean, that was, so that sort of, at that time, there was like, I swear they were called casuals, but the casuals were geezers sitting around listening to 12-inch dub smoking gear.
Yeah.
Like, no clubs, no nothing. It was just that. It was just like, they'd, like, you'd see them at clubs and have Italian slip-ons, Farrah's, Wexman's, and the Gabici chain.
Yeah.
Definitely, you know, curly hair or, you know, perm or whatever.
Yeah.
Just hanging about with West Indian lads. But it was all, I mean, that's, you couldn't help it, really. If you come from Stratford, Forest Gate, Manor Park, Ilford, that was our...
Yeah,
you know, we were all very mixed crowd.
Yeah.
So that's where that was the thing at the time, and as soon as sort of, I mean, really, like, one of the faces was Kieran McMahon, like, you know, and he was like sort of top boy and ex-boxer, Bridge House, you know, blah blah blah. I remember seeing him, and he went, look me up and down, and it was only like probably. Early 79, he went, oh, he's still a fucking mud. And I went, oh, I was gutted, like, because he was a bit older and he knew me. Yeah. Like, wee! And then the other thing, he's still a fucking mug. And he was, he was a casual and he had a, belcher on and, you know what I mean? And that was, that was that early thing of casual. And it, so it was like, those that blew out the mod thing stepped straight into this casual thing with the Kabiches and the Farrahs and all that. And then, really quickly, they were wearing Pringles and Lyle and Scott. Really quickly. You know, that chat, and that was the thing. I used to say this at the time, that the casual scene was more mod than the mod scene.
Because they
were listening to, like, import house music, so imported soul records.
Yeah.
They were changing fashions like that, you know what I mean? It's like, that, you know, I see me mates, like one of the under fives, see him on the train, and he had Sergio on, covered in plaster.
Yeah.
And I went, all right, Stu, how you doing? He went, yeah, all right, mate, blah, blah, blah. And I went, is that one of them Sergio Ciccini's? And he went, yeah. And I went, ain't they 70 quid? And that was just the tracksuit top, not the bottoms.
Yeah.
And I went, ain't they 70 quid? And he went, yeah, all the fucking Northerners are wearing them now. Do you know what I mean? It was like bang, bang, bang. That was all within a year or so. It went from Kabiches to Pringles to Sergio, like, in certainly by 1980, early 80, I reckon it was 78, 79.
Yeah.
In that year, that fashion went jun, 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 and they were just quick. They were like, you're listening to this, you're wearing that, you're wearing Nike, you know, you're wearing, it was more Adidas from London's point of view, more than Nike. But then again, you could go, you could spot Arsenal, because they'd have a Nike on.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And you could spot Chelsea, because they'd still be wearing donkey jackets, knob-nail boots, and mugs. So, you know what I mean? It was that quick, you know what I mean? That fashion was just, it was great to watch it, it was almost like, I was cool for about 20 minutes. Do you know what I mean? There was a point in 1978, between 78 and summer of 78, summer of 79, there was a point there I was cool,
because
the big boys, I was wearing what the big boys were wearing, and one of the big boys also said, I painted in up for me art exam, and painted the jam in black and white on the back of me parka in a circle thing, and it was half black, and anyway, it was almost two-tony thing. But that was it, and I was a bit mute, you know, and I knew I had the special record for everyone else and all that, you know what I mean? So it was, there was a point I was cool, but within a year, it was like, I was just a mug. Oh, you're still a mod. You know, it went back to that, and it's like I was going football with all my mates in all their fucking gear, and I was like, jean jacket. I'll get away with a jean jacket, we moved on from the Parkers very quickly, you know what I mean? It was great because we could still walk into shops in East London and just pick stuff, like new old stock off the shelf. Literally, you know what I mean? There was quite a few old Jewish tailors and old Jewish outfitters and clothes shops like Leech's in Canning Town, where you could literally walk in and everything was still there from the 60s. Nothing had changed.
Yeah.
They hadn't restocked. They were just massive outlets, and they just had all the gear.
Yeah.
The Army and Navy is all down the road, all down Romford Road from Whitechapel right the way down. They always had old stock Levi's, 501, you know, they had all the gear. Because it never, you know, if it didn't sell in the 60s, it was only 15 years later, like from 64. So, you know, they were still getting that gear in 67, 68. Still go and buy hipsters, especially skinny mates, you know what I mean? You still buy hipsters and all that. And one time, someone's mum walked, she was like a modernist, and she come home and she said to her son, she went, oh, they've got original 501 white 501 denim jean jackets. But it weren't denim, it was actually white denim, but it weren't dyed denim. It was actually white cotton.
Yeah, yeah.
Jean jackets from Levi's, really thick and everything. In they'd suddenly put them in the winter. I think that was £4.50 or something. In the Army and Navy at Manor Park. Fucking amazing. So he's told me, he's gone and got one, he's told me, I've told Martin, like, the bridge house the next Monday,
yeah.
I counted 42. I stood on the stage, like, and I went, hold on, and I went, and I counted how many white jean jackets out of the crowd of like 150 people going, seeing this. You know, Purple Arts, wherever it was, there was 42 blokes in white denim jean jackets. Basically, we bought the whole lot, all our little East London lot, bought every single one, like, and they wore, like, forever, like, you know what I mean? But they were just, we were lucky we could buy all that gear just off the cuff, you know what I mean?
I mean, West Ham was synonymous with the green flight jacket.
Yeah, yeah, and that sort of come out the mod thing. That was a, like, you know, that was the replacement for the Parker.
Yeah.
One, they were expensive.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
The reverse.
Yeah. Yeah. They were reversible. You know what I mean? Orange. Yeah. Some people wore them with orange, but they was definitely, you know, and that sort of Lonsdale. You know, that with a Lonsdale shirt, West claret and blue Lonsdale shirt underneath, that was your kit, you know what I mean? Pair of DMs and 501s, you know what I mean? Or Wranglers, whatever.
Yeah.
And that was the look, but you could see the air changing.
Yeah.
So you could see people's air changing, and that didn't fit.
Yeah.
If you look at them, you look at old pictures of that period, because you only see photos really, no document, like video documentary.
Yeah.
But of West Ham, you can see that looks change, like people still wearing that like flight jacket, but their hair's got a bit longer, or it's got a bit longer at the back, and all, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that was like all in that really short period, like 78 to say summer 78 to summer 80.
Yeah.
Well, not even that. Summer 78 to Christmas 79. It's like it went bang, 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 and it suddenly became a thing.
Yeah.
And it was like mod was, that was the end of mod. Do you know what I mean? I literally thought I was the last mod in fucking East London.
But there was still quite a mod scene, wasn't there, throughout the 80s?
Yeah. So that was, I think the thing was, we got tired of the bands very quickly.
Right. Yeah.
But we were still going to see bands. I mean, I'll speak to certain band members and they go, oh, you killed our band. No, we didn't. It was just like, we were still going to see bands, just weren't your band.
Yeah.
You know, we'd rather go and see the Q-Tips than we would go and see fucking Kilometres or Squire. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Fucking Squire was shit anyway. But, you know, I mean, even the Calls and the Purple Arts, they were sort of our mates.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But certainly, like, you know, I'd rather go and see the Q-Tips in 1980 than I would see Secret Affair in 1980.
But a lot of things different to now. A lot of things, everything happened so fast.
Yeah.
Music changed, and it's kind of, for me as a kid growing up, all I wanted to do was listening to new music. So I would imagine it would have been the same for you.
Exactly. You know, and you've got to remember, we had the added addition of we'd gone from, like, Punks in Parkers, because we didn't have a mods book, we didn't have the, you know what I mean, we didn't have none of that, we didn't know, we were basically all listening to punk, and then we were mods, so we were listening to slightly different punk, but still, you know, called Purple Arts, both punk bands, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But the addition was, we were discovering 60s music.
Yeah.
So we all would have, certainly me, I had, like, you know, Spencer Davis and records, singles and Small Faces that people would just give, family just give, you know, you just, he likes records, I'll have some records, you know what I mean? It's like that sort of thing of, and you could still go, you know, the main thing I would buy in second-hand shops was not clothes, singles.
Records.
You know, and it was just like, if the label looked 60s, I'd buy it for 10p.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was like 10p, 5p, 10p.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And it's like, you know, I picked, you know, one of the most influential albums for me was The Sue Story, which didn't really buy that many albums, but it looked very mod, because it had a black geezer on the front and a bloke in a shirt and tie.
Yeah.
And that album was just like, wow, what the... And I'm like taking it to parties.
Yeah.
Oh, let me put on like Ike and Tina Turner, and people go, it's fucking Tina Turner. And it was like, I can't believe what you say, because I see what you do. And all they wanted was My Generation.
Yeah.
So already our little group was moving into a different genre, like a different sound.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you know, that, you know, and then, like, we stumbled across the Six T's. Like, me and my mate was going, after the mods book came out in 79, and we trawled through that and looked for places to go. If there was nothing on, he had a Mini. He was a year older, so he was old enough to drive, and he could use his mum's Mini. So we drove up to West Hampstead, where Clute's Cleek, Railway Hotel. Gone up there, gone in, and and I still can't remember if it's upstairs or downstairs. But the Irish got up at Lagerich, and like the Irish governor, he went, "Your ladder upstairs." We walked upstairs, and it's 50p or 20, I think it was 20p something to get in, and it was 60s, like around Ian Aidy, and it was like, oh, this fucking music's brilliant. Didn't have a clue what it was. Like, there was a geezer, like, you know, a couple of geezers backflipping his tiny little room, you know what I mean? It was like, what the fuck's this all about, you know what I mean? But that was it. And then we were down, like, they didn't have it. I don't think they had any flyers there, but a couple of weeks later, it was in Kensington Market, and my mate went, "Here, Bob, is that place you went?" And it was like the 60s thing, but it was now in Oxford Street or Charing Cross, Tottenham Court Road. It was in the pub next to the Dominion. We went, "Oh, we'll go there." And that was a mob of us turned up. Like, we all met in met in the Chatsworth or the Foresters, might be the Foresters. And we went in the West End from there, like, you know what I mean? And that was the start of that journey, which certainly wasn't Northern Soul then. It was R&B, you know what I mean? Like, not even fast, it was really good R&B stuff, do you know what I mean?
But that was a lifeline for Northern Soul, wasn't it? The mod scene coming through.
Oh, God, AD still ain't credited me for saving his paying for his mortgage for buying him houses, all of them. But, by the time it was about three or four events later that they got to the 100 Club and stayed in the 100 Club, and then the all-nighter started.
Yeah.
The time you got to the first all-nighter, it was all fucking mobs.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it weren't Northern, you know, it weren't Northern.
It was a lot of R&B, my interpretation.
It's like Etta James and Something's Gotten Hold on Me, you know, all that sort of stuff you'd say now in the age of Spotify were standards that you certainly couldn't hear them records anywhere else.
You know
what I mean? You couldn't hear them, certainly couldn't hear them on the radio, and they were hard to buy. You know what I mean? But we were still, coming back to that where we were in East London, you could still go into sweet shops and they'd have a rack of singles. So then you'd start going through and looking for certain labels and certain artists and all the British. So the British issue, you know, the majority of our record collections in the first three or four years of mod were British labels.
Yeah.
You know, they were all stateside, you know, London American, you know, so all of that stuff. I mean, but even Sue then was quite hard because it was collectible on the collectible market.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Nothing to do with soul or any of that.
Yeah.
But all them records you could, you know, you would pick stuff up you'd never heard. Yeah. You know, and in amongst that was like, you know, Spencer Davis, Herbie Goins and Nighttimers, all them great British bands as well, you know, Cyril Davis, all that stuff. You could just pick it up everywhere you went.
Yeah.
You know, record, and then they started having record fairs. We found out what record fairs were, you know what I mean? And it was great, you know, and that was, so that sort of fed into the thing that we weren't really listening to them sort of bands anymore. We'd grown out of punk.
Yeah.
You know, and they were still playing punk. And they were, in fact, you think about it, you know, 1980, they'd been playing them same songs for 2 years.
Yeah.
You know, how many times do you want to hear a Type Reaction?
Exactly.
How many times do you want to hear Now It's Gone? Like, now it's gone, it's a brilliant record. But it's like we were moving quickly.
Yeah.
Even within the mod scene, we were East London, so we was a mob. We wouldn't go anywhere on our own. It was always we'd meet in a pub and then go out, whether it was a gig or anything. But also fashion-wise, we were fucking miles in front of them. Do you know what I mean? Not wearing parkas, wearing, you know, tailored trousers, step bottoms, split bottoms, you know what I mean? covered buttons, all overcoat. I mean, over, well, the kings of the overcoats, because everywhere you, you know, wherever you lived in East London, there was an old tailor's, or there was an old like an old clothes shop that you could just walk in and take stuff off the rail. How much did I miss that? £2. Because they were £2 in 1966.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? We still had like tags on them and shirts. I mean, you know, we were buying boxed shirts.
Yeah.
There was a place in Grants in Limehouse, and he just had stacks and stacks of shirts. Like, I would, you know, pull them down, don't know what was in there.
Yeah.
Blew the, literally blowing dust off.
Yeah.
And like, what's that? Oh, button down, brilliant. Oh, like, oh, tab collar, oh, brilliant. Like, you know, looking at these different, you know, just discovering.
Yeah.
It was like discovering, it was no different from discovering a great record.
Yeah, yeah.
Discovering a great brand new shirt.
Yeah.
Or a brand new coat.
Yeah.
Or, you know, or a tailor's that had just shut down and just opened up again. I mean, one of them was me mates. I was working on building sites, so you'd be somewhere different every week.
Yeah.
And my lunch times was like, they're all going, where are you going, pub? No, I'm going out looking. And I'd just go out looking for old shops.
Yeah.
Where I was in the city, West London, wherever I was working, I'd find old shops, like, you know what I mean? Found one over in near Portobello, another one like Silk Street up in the city. You know, there was just shops.
Yeah.
There you could go in and they had old, excuse me, mister, have you got any old stock?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Brush your cement dust off, whatever. And it was just like that. And then my mates come round, Russell Harris, always had a lovely GS. He's come round and goes, I found one. I went, what? He goes, I found a clothes shop. I went, fucking brilliant. And it was down just past Mile End Station on the right-hand side. And it was, he drove past it a lot because it still had the old signage up.
Yeah.
But all of a sudden the shutters were up. And he said he went in, he stopped his scooter and he parked it. Because you'd always park your scooter around the corner so he didn't look like a mod.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a weird thing, but they, you know, they weren't interested. They want money. They're not interested in a load of fucking spotty Herberts.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, so he's gone in and there was an old couple in there and they were just sort of sweeping up. The woman said to him, oh, we'll be back Monday. We'll be open Monday. He went, oh, all right, like blah blah blah. So flew down there Monday, and because he said what's in the window is all like Wrangler, hipsters, in one window, and Wrangler and Levi hipsters and overcoats in the other window, and it was like exactly. So what they'd done, we spoke to them like the following week, and they'd shut up shop in '68, and moved to Spain,
right,
and they'd come back to sell the shop.
Yeah, yeah.
Because like, yeah, not me, it's not 1980, 70, yeah, about 1980.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
They still, and it was, nothing had changed.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything was in there. I mean, we had the man, because it was all like the 60s, it was all like skinny, everyone fitted everything. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I bought as much, I'd done a week's wages in there.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was buying these golf jackets in like boxes, like thin boxes, but they were boxes. Like that, and there was brown, blue, beige, red, and they were like Harrington, but with no elastic on the sleeves or on the cuffs. And the cuffs were sort of like that, and they were for golf. They were literally golf jackets with no lining.
Yeah.
So you could wear a jumper underneath, but they had the button up like that. And I went, oh, how much are they? And he went, oh, it was 30 bob each for them. Like, you know what I mean? £1.50. So I was buying them and selling them for a tenner because I knew they'd fly out. You know what I mean? Got a big, lovely tweed overcoat. I mean, it was just, we had 2 weeks of absolute freedom of going in there every Thursday because we were all on building site. And Mark worked in the city, so he had like Fridays. But all the like sort of East London sort of core group, about five of us, were all going up there and just giving them all the money we could because everything in there was just cool.
Yeah, yeah.
And if it fitted, that was it. You know what I mean? It was just fucking cool. Got a load of box of cufflinks I got out there for £1. I said, oh, you got any old cufflinks? I need like, and they'd just go out the back and pull something out. And it was a box of cufflinks like that.
Yeah, yeah.
In like cardboard, but all separated. And it was just like pairs of cufflinks like that. You know, you open them up, it's like a ring box. and there was a pair of couplings. It was mental.
Yeah.
Amount of stuff we could make millions. But millionaires this time next year. So 2 weeks later, gone there, nothing. What's going on? Sharon, I remember the missus' name, Sharon. Can't remember the old boy's name. And I went, what's happened, Sharon? And we're closing up now, we've got a buyer. And some lovely boys from Portobello Road come down, and they bought everything.
Just for St. George.
And I asked Eddie years later, and it's still, I'd asked Barry, and he didn't have a clue, but when I asked Eddie about 10 years ago, actually, I went, I've got to ask you this. And he said, oh, yeah. He goes, it was his, the other partner, Marco, or one of them,
three of them
was Jewish, or his family was Jewish on his mother's side or his wife's side or whatever, and their family had all the army and navies from there all the way down to Southend. That family, like the cousins, uncles, cousin, dad. So as soon as the shop got stock, because we thought, because this happened a couple of times in a couple of different venues, and we thought we had a spy. We thought someone was, we was actually going down Portobello Road looking for these geezers that was selling all this mod gear, because we thought we had a spy. But what it was, they had a relation that was the family, and as soon as they knew they were still in the rag trade, so as soon as they bought anything, as soon as they was selling up, they'd go in there. He said to me that they went, the another one we found was Dagenham Heathway, where the Ford plant was. There was one sort of, it was a wrapped up within the Ford plant, was a row of shops.
Right, okay.
On the road, but it was and this Army and Navy was massive, but it gradually got smaller and smaller and smaller. Yeah, yeah. It was all crammed in the corner, and my scooter broke down, and I went in there, and can I leave my scooter in your yard? And I've got to go home and get some tools. And they went, yeah, no problem. And I went, whoa, what's in here? And there was all this like sports gear, and it was like basically they had like a fashion bit, and then they had this bit, and then they had a denim bit, and a shop, and then it was all crammed into this thing, but it was mostly sport. So it was a load of Wembley balls. We all got Wembley balls, and who was I talking about? Marco?
Eddie.
And Eddie said, he goes, that paid for my first house. I said, why's that? He said, when we got the word that they were selling up, he goes, we went in there and they had these boxes, like wall of boxes with different sizes in, with all branded with Levi's.
Yeah.
So it was like size 25, 26, 28, 20, blah, blah, all the different sizes. And he said, what they used to do was, when the new stock come in, they'd put the size 28s in there, piled up. And then the others would move to the back. So they were like tunnels going right to the back. And he goes, when we got them out, he goes, all it, because at the time it was all the Japanese.
This is
1990s.
Yeah.
So this was by that late. And he said, all the Japanese, all the Big E stuff and all that, they just had it right off. Because they were paying £1 a pair.
Yeah.
They would have all the Levi's £1 a pair, have the lot, and as they were clearing them out, they was getting further and further to the back, and everything, you know, it was getting better and better and better. And they had all the original sort of like cowboy stuff and all that mental going right back to the 50s. Fucking mad stuff. Like.
So what about scooter boys? When did they start coming through on the mud scene?
Who cares?
But that was 84?
No, I think it came hand in hand. I mean, they were there because they were up north.
Yeah.
So they used to like slag us off because we had short hair and we nearly had a row with a load of northern blokes in Victoria once. We was going to the venue and we was in the Wimpy or whatever, and all these squaddies, northern squaddies, come round and like, who fucking, we're mods, mate. What are you? And we went, oh, what fucking regiment? No, we're mods. You know what I mean? My brother's a mod and he's got long hair and you fucking Norman cunt. But we got away with it anyway. But they was threatening us because we had short hair, and they thought that's what squaddies were, and mods didn't look like that because where they come from.
Yeah.
So I think the thing was, it was when we used to go to rallies and all that, and like, you know, a couple of the Lambretta national rallies to Brighton, it kicked off, and that was a lot of football.
Yeah.
You know, that was like, you know, there was always a big Firmamanx, always, everywhere you went. It was a big, like, there must have been 10 scooter clubs around Manchester, around the area, Stockport and what have you. So there was always big mobs of Manx, and obviously we didn't get on Man United, and they thought they were the dogs, and they weren't. And also they looked at us like pussies. So they looked at us like we were all airy-fairy, you know, mods, because we was smart and all that. But obviously, when we was, you know, when we had that mods thing, it was, you'd have West Ham, Millwall, Chelsea, Arsenal, not so much Tottenham, no one likes them. But you know what I mean? It was a London, mob.
Yeah.
But at a scooter rally.
Yeah.
So when the Northerners come up against us, don't matter if there was 200 of them, 30 of us just going, like, I mean, you know, there's gas going off and thunder flashes and all. Everything that was at football in the early 80s was at mod rallies, and it surprised them to say the least. You know what I mean? And it's, that's that story in your pub, Mick, wasn't it? That was the pub we blew up because we had a mob of skinheads in the other bar, and we dropped thunder flashes in the pool, at the holes of the pool table, went round there because they were mobbing up to do, like, oh, well, you could come here, we're a load of East London mods, want to have it, and we were actually there already, but only a few of us, so we just blew them up. Literally blew the fucker, skinhead cut towards him. We went, I don't want no trouble, and one side of his face completely black, and the other side was white where he'd put his hand. But it was just, and the scooter boy thing was, I think that you've got to look at that. So once again, we look at 81. By 81, the Northern Soul thing was big. So definitely come 82. I'd say 82, you started seeing people coming to clubs in army greens. Which was a Northern thing, do you know what I mean? But Northern Soul. So once again, you've got another... So you've already had mod turn, like groups of mods becoming psychedelic for a bit. So you had another change in fashion. And then you had... So this is like, you know, from Parker Boys to actual mods to R&B loving soul, you know, Rhythm and Soul, was Rhythm and Soul Society, we were called at one point. And then the Northern Soul thing, 18 months. And it's mad, isn't it? I mean, it's like, even if you say 2 years, all right, let's push it to 2 years. That's a lot of fashion in 2 years. For a mass... like culture to undergo all those different changes. But every time that cycle happened, you, like, people would drop off. So you'd have less and less and less and less and less. So like if the scooter boy thing when the scooter boy thing happened, some of them carried on being scooter boys and just obsessing over, you know, fresco pipes and fucking cut downs and things like that, you know what I mean? So, you know, they kept with that. And so every time it changed, and it's like all revolutions, you know, it's just constant like that, it's changing. And every time you lose a bit of fat. Do you know what I mean? So come 83, I reckon 83, what was left of the mod scene was fucking cool. One, it was all over the London, so it was everyone, you know, a few South London, East London, North London, you know, it was people from Essex, people from Cheshunt, all over the place, still wanted to listen to mod music, when the whole world and every scooter run we went to was playing Out on the Floor and Al Wilson's a Snake. And we didn't want to hear that. We wanted to hear mod music. You know what I mean? So that's, we started up like Crawdaddy and Sneakers in Shepherd's Bush was sort of West London, and we had Crawdaddy in East and South London, and it was back to roots, and it was back to playing R&B, back to playing the stuff we originally heard down the Marquee, the 100 Club, 6Ts, that early R&B, or early soul, you'd say, like Rhythm and Soul. So we went back to that, and then, you know, Ed and Terry started a record label, and we had it, everything was there on the plate for us. And then we started getting pressed by about 84. It became cool again. Do you know what I mean? And it was like, you know, with Fast Eddie, the Untouchables, Making Time, all those bands could have made it. You know, the Untouchables did, but
they never really took off, did
they? Well, the thing was, the curse of Maud is there was the second week they were due to be on Top of the Pops, or the second time. So you do Top of the Pops when you went in the charts, then you'd get you wouldn't be able to do it the next week. But if your record climbed the following week, you could be on Top of the Pops again. So two hits on Top of the Pops, and we've part Stiff Record. So Ed found them, and then we give them to Stiff Records to sign, because they were obviously going to be too big for us. And it was like they come. They were definitely booked to go on it, because the record went up like another 10 places. So it went in at like in top 40, then it went to 29, and then the following week it went to 19 or 18 or 19. So it was definitely going to get on Top of the Pops. Fucking strike. Strike by the cameramen. And they didn't have a Top of the Pops that week. You know, there's probably 10 times in the history of Top of the Pops there was no Top of the Pops on a Thursday. And that was one of them.
And that's why it failed. Right, one last question. When did the term casuals first get mentioned or used?
Well, I just think that was... Well, the casuals, as I said, the casuals were the geezers in the dub and reggae really early on. Plus 78. Like, they were casuals. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, I remember my mum ironing my shirt and my mate sitting there waiting. And my mum was ironing me a shirt, and we were going... I'm probably going football, but... We were going somewhere, and she went, "Oh, why can't you dress more casual like your mates?" And like, they thought it was the most funniest thing ever. Like, you know what I mean? Because, you know, they had sort of beaches, like stuff you didn't have to iron, like Lonsdale on or whatever. You know what I mean? So that was our early on. That was the casual thing, and it was separate from Soul Boys. Soul Boys was a different look. You know what I mean? But the early casuals, that sort of Gabici, you know, Gregory Isaacs type of look, Bob Marley. That was the look they were going for. And it kept on for nearly 6 months.
Thank you, Bob.
Cheers, mate.
Thank you.